Good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to speak just a couple of minutes here with Jennifer Fahey, who is the Communications Director for Farm Aid 2011, and chat a bit about that event coming up this Saturday. So stick around. This hour is sponsored by David Burleson. Thank you, David. And as you know, the program all last week and this week is underwritten by Farm Aid 2011 and BioWilly and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. Annie Nelson will be on tomorrow night to talk about BioWilly and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. So if you have questions what that's about, if you did your homework like I asked you to last week, you did a Google or went to Wikipedia and looked it up. But I know about you people. You don't do your homework assignments. You really don't. You just don't do them. So we'll talk with Annie Nelson tomorrow, and she'll explain it all. Farm Aid 2011 is going to happen in Kansas City, Kansas, this Saturday. Like I've been telling you, it's the first time the concert will be staged in Kansas. I have in front of me the media backgrounder, all the information about Farm Aid. We've been talking about it, little bits and pieces, the past week and last night and tonight. And the reason we've been talking about it, aside from the fact that they are sponsor underwriting the program for 2 weeks, is the fact that it is a very important event. It continues the work that Willie Nelson, when we spoke to him last week, you remember what we talked about, it started back in 85 when the news was about farmers committing suicide because their farms are being auctioned, everything they own. If you are of a certain age, you remember those images on television. Willie Nelson, Neil Young, and John Mellencamp started it all in 1985. They organized the first Farm Aid concert to keep family farmers on their land. In 2001, Dave Matthews joined the Farm Aid board. And the objective, as we've been mentioning the past week, is to keep family farmers and family ranchers where they belong. We're not talking about factory farms. We're not talking about the corporate farming industry that continues to poison us, that continues how quickly the story of the poisoned turkey meat disappeared off the newscasts. Cargill is a major corporation in this country. It is a major contributor to both Democrats and Republicans, and it is a major contributor to sickness in this country. So notice how quickly that story disappeared. What? There's no more. What was it, Kathy? Some strain of some weird bacterium from a different time, a different dimension. Who knows with what they put in the food? So Farm Aid is about more than helping farmers who are in distress, as they were 26 years ago. It's also about the good food industry, small farmers, a lot of organic stuff, sustainable farming, farming that does not destroy the land or pollute the waterways or fill up with the aquifers with poison. Have you ever been near a big pig operation? I have. I used to live in North Carolina. Let me tell you something. You get downwind from one of those big pig factory farms. By downwind, I mean 12 miles downwind. And try to breathe. Oh, what the hell. I could just go on here all night. Jennifer Fahey joins us from Kansas City. Hey, Jennifer.
Hi, Mike. I think you could compete with Neil Young on your factory farm rant.
Oh, really? Yeah, it drives me crazy. I mean, the whole thing. And like I've said on the program, it goes back to those images all those years ago. I had no idea in 1985. I knew during the bad old Reagan years, I knew that people were going through bankruptcies. Now it's homes that people are losing. Back then it was farms that people were losing. And it's just killer stuff. I hate it. I have such deep respect for Willie Nelson for having put this together back in 85. To see socially responsible, socially committed artists is I mean, that's the whole idea of art, isn't it? I mean, I think it is.
I think it's good that people like Willie choose to use that platform for good.
Yeah.
For sure.
How does it look for Farm Aid 2011? This is your first time in Kansas, right?
It is our first time in Kansas. It's our 26th year. It's looking great. We're at a brand new venue this year, the Livestock Sporting Park. Speaking of doing good, it's the first venue in the world that is philanthropic. Instead of selling their naming rights to a corporation, they called up Livestrong and said, we want to give you money, and we want to broadcast your message. So we're really proud to be there.
Wow.
And, yeah, and talking about good health, which is part of their message as well, and good farmers and good food.
Who is Livestrong? I have to plead complete ignorance here.
Oh, well, you know the yellow bracelets, the Lance Armstrong.
Yes.
Initiative. Yep. They're revolutionizing the fight against cancer.
I see.
And it's a huge foundation completely dedicated to eradicating cancer and helping folks who are going through cancer right now. So,
well, it's exciting
for us to partner with them.
Yeah, I was going to say it's very appropriate then for what you all are doing with Farm Aid to be in that venue. Who's on the lineup this year? I know Neil Young, Dave Matthews. Who all is going to be there? I mean, just hearing the names makes me wish I could jump on a plane and come out there, which I can't. But, I mean, you know, I'll be watching it on television or on the website, trust me. But who's Great. Going to be there this year?
Well, as always, we have our board members, Willie Nelson, John Mellencamp, Neil Young, Dave Matthews. And we also have folks like Jason Mraz, Jamie Johnson, Jacob Dylan, Billy Joe Shaver, Willie's son Lucas Nelson and his band Promise of the Real, Ray Price, Robert Francis, Will Daly and the Rivals, Rebecca Pigeon, the Blackwood Quartet, John Trudell, and we just added a new Kansas City band called Hearts of Darkness.
Huh. How is this concert received in the areas where it's played over these past 26 years? And I'm thinking about the fact that you all do this in areas, so-called red states, that don't seem, unless I'm missing something here, don't seem real open to the kind of social activism that Farm Aid is involved in. How are you received in these states when you do these concerts?
We are received really well. We are all about a positive message, and it's one that isn't red or blue. It's so basic. It's our food, and as Willie has said, we all eat. And, you know, Farm Aid is about issues and important messages, but we could all use some good news right now, I think.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. It's pretty tough out there, and so Farm Aid is also about a celebration, and it's about a celebration of the values that family farmers bring us and the solutions they represent for our economy, our environment, our health. And it's about the inspiration, too, and the deeper connection they can help us make every time we eat.
So you're saying that when these concerts are put together and the performers come out and the people in the state or the area, the county where these are held, they understand the difference between factory farming, corporate farming, and that sort of farming, and the kind of thing that Willie Nelson and Farm Aid backs, which is sustainable farming. Because I just wonder how many people do understand food production has been taken over by four or five mega corporations in this country, all the way down to the genetic level, where they now, as you know, can alter the gene structure of plants that we are then going to eat. I mean, just thinking about that makes my skin crawl. And I just wonder how the people, for example, this time in Kansas City, how do they perceive what you all are doing versus what a company like Cargill is doing? I'll tell you what, Jennifer, can you just hold on for a second? I got to take a break. And
okay.
If you can, answer that when we come back. All right?
Sure.
All right, we're talking with Jennifer Fahey, who is the communications director for Farm Aid 2011. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. 21 past the hour. Excuse me. We're talking with Jennifer Fahey, who is the communications director for Farm Aid 2011. The difference, Jennifer, do people understand the difference between the factory farms and independent small farmers and small ranchers?
I think a lot of them who come to the Farm Aid concert do. And, you know, the situation with the factory farms starting up in the early 90s was actually brought to us by the people who are living in those states that are or have been red states. You know, it's the people living in Missouri, Ohio, Iowa, Illinois. They brought it to our attention first because they were living there. They saw what it did to their neighborhood. They saw their kids not being able to go outside in the backyard and play. You know, they smelled it. They saw what it did to the main street businesses. So, you know, these folks know it because they live it. And, you know, the way that some folks, the big ag companies portray it as, you know, it's just city people coming in and people who hate technology. That's not true. It's the people living in these rural communities. It's farmers who see what happens to their business and what happens to their family. And when their kids leave town and don't want to farm because they don't see the promise, you know, right. Luckily that's turning around, and it's because people are realizing that they can have a lot of impact with where they spend their money and what they eat.
Somebody just sent me an email about one of the founders of Doctors Without Borders, a Dr. Servan Schreiber, who wrote a book entitled Anti-Cancer, A New Way of Life. It's about factory farming and how it has such an impact on the diseases that seem to be just incurable in this country, like cancer, like chronic diabetes, like heart disease. And it intrigues me that given all that we have come to understand about toxins, about poison in the environment, about how we're changing the environment, that people haven't come to a complete understanding that factory farming and genetic alterations of plant species and animal species is not the way to go. That the way to go is just to do, I mean, the earth is there. We have seeds, plant it, harvest it, and sell it. You know, it knocks me out, Jennifer. I mean, that we don't get the connection between disease and what we're eating. I'm not saying all diseases are caused by what we eat, but dear God, I mean, what kind of proof do we need that these mass producers of food are not the least bit interested in nutrition? What they're interested in, as any corporation is, in profit. And if that requires this kind of dumping this poison into the American consumer's grocery basket, well, so, I mean, so what, right?
Well, and you mentioned at the top of the hour here that we've got this turkey recall. The offending thing they found in it was salmonella, and that salmonella was antibiotic resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a result of the antibiotics that are being used in our factory farm system that pumps these animals full of antibiotics to keep them healthy when they're living in the system that cannot keep them healthy. So now we've got, you know, folks going to the hospital with diseases that we can't fix because they're antibiotic resistant. You know, that's the bad news. The good news is folks are waking up. They are taking control. And we've got the numbers to prove it. We've got more farmers on the land than we had in 1985 for the first time. Since 1985, the Ag Census came back and said we have a net plus in farmers. We have 7,000 farmers markets. We have farmers who are doing cooperative or community-supported agriculture programs, CSAs, where people at the start of the season can purchase a share. Mm. So they become shareholders in this farm. And each week during the harvest, they get their basket of the produce and harvest. And those farmers are selling out, you know. Mm. And farmers markets are starting up, and they can't find farmers for the markets because people are demanding so much of this good food that we don't yet have the farmers to supply it all. So we've got to do more. And we've got to do more to get new farmers on the land, and that's what FarmAid is working on. We were at the White House last month to talk to them about the need for family farmers to have good access to credit, like all Americans, but especially family farmers rely on credit. We've got drought and flooding and tornadoes. Our farmers are suffering crop losses this year, and without credit next year, they're not going to be able to put a crop in the ground.
Right. Jennifer, I have another break here. Can you stick around just a couple more minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay, let me, let me put you on hold, and we'll come back and chat after this break for just a couple more minutes. We're talking with Jennifer Fahey. She is the communications director for FarmAid 2011. As I mentioned this week, go to the website, farmaid.org. If you cannot attend the concert, you can still watch it at that website, listen to it at that website this Saturday. But also, if you want to support FarmAid and don't know how to do it, the website will tell you how to do that. There's a form on the site also to, or there was, I think it's still there, to contact your senator about this issue. So stick around. We're going to talk with Jennifer a little bit more. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour, this hour is sponsored by David Burleson, underwritten by FarmAid 2011, and BioDiesel. BioWilly and the Sustainable BioDiesel Alliance. We're talking for a few more minutes here with Jennifer Fahey, who is the communications director for FarmAid 2011. You were mentioning right before we took that break, Jennifer, about some of the natural disasters that the farmers are facing this year. It's been horrific here in Georgia. We've had drought. We've had heat waves that are indescribable. Plus, you know, the crazy people that run the Georgia General Assembly. This is kind of funny and a real sick, twisted way, but they passed a very stringent, strict, punishing law in the state about undocumented workers. Well, in South Georgia, the cotton and peanut crops and other crops depend on these undocumented workers. Have every year the migrants who come in and do the work and move on. So now we have farmers in South Georgia who can't get their produce out of the fields. A, B, since they can't do that, they are not able to sell what they've grown. A lot of them are nailed to the wall financially because of loans they may have taken. And now there's a real possibility of, and I hate to politicize this, but Republican farmers who put into office Republican representatives in the Georgia General Assembly to do just this are now going to find themselves facing bankruptcy. I mean, this is madness. There are so many aspects of this, of being a farmer or a rancher in these times that is just incredible. I don't see how these people continue with the stress levels that must be coming up here.
Right, and the same thing is happening in the dairy industry. They're going to make farmers liable for proving their, or asking their employees to prove that they are
documented,
you know, able to work in the U.S., right. And so then the farmer is on the line. And these are farmers. These are not business people who can go and do background checks and employ people and lawyers and the whole rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
These are folks trying to make an honest living on the land. And they're up against, you know, Mother Nature, and they're up against corporate concentration. And that's why FarmAid is here. 26 years later, there's a lot of work we've got to still get done.
What is, just generally speaking, I know it's impossible for anybody connected with FarmAid to keep track of this. I'm assuming that Hell, I don't know. Maybe you have economists on your staff, but what are farmers generally speaking facing now vis-a-vis 1985? Those images of farmers being standing back under a tree watching as an auctioneer auctioned everything. I can still see that. And what generally speaking, what kind of financial shape are farmers in now?
Well, we worked with an economist. We don't have one on staff, but we worked with a great one out of Tufts University this March to help him do his analysis of, it was the 2009 numbers that were most available from the USDA, because, of course, you know, the line is that farmers are making a killing right now. They're out buying new trucks and tractors, and everyone's doing great with $7 corn.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, in 2009, which was a pretty good year for crop prices, the average family farmer made less than $20,000 from the farm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 90% of our farmers have off-farm jobs to supply health insurance and life insurance and, you know, a wage they can count on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an uphill battle. Credit, as I mentioned, having access to credit and affordable credit at that. Dairy farmers for 3 years suffered prices that were less than what they had to pay out to produce that milk.
Mm-hmm.
A business can't do that for 3 years. We lost a lot of our dairy farmers. And, you know, as we lose our independent dairy farmers, we see more and more power in larger corporate farms. And those are the major things that farmers are up against. You know, we've been bringing these issues to the attention of the administration and the USDA, and there have been a lot of promising signs. Last year, the Department of Justice and the USDA held a series of workshops across the country looking at corporate concentration and possible antitrust violations in agriculture. And agriculture is the most concentrated market out there, you know, upwards of 80% of our livestock and feed markets are controlled by 1, 2, 3 firms. So there's a lot that family farmers are up against, and yet they're still out there doing it, and they're doing it all for us, you know. So Farm Aid is really trying to bring about that awareness every time we sit down and eat, you know, who grew our food and what did they have to go through to get it, and did they earn a living wage, and, you know, what can we all do to get involved?
And I want to just restate the obvious. Part of Farm Aid 2011, the concert, is about fun, about having a good time, about listening to some to great music by some of this country's greatest performers. And the fact that you all can blend entertainment on that level with what is a list of superstars in the music business. You can blend that and the entertainment factor with the very real awareness that has got to come if Americans are going to A, improve their diets, and B, support the people who really are, and this is a part that's kind of heartbreaking, they really are the backbone of this country. And I have the deepest respect for what you all are doing. And I hope that this concert this Saturday is going to be a success.
Thank you very much. We hope so, too. And we hope we see your listeners, if not in Kansas, on the website, farmaid.org, for our webcast.
That sounds great. Jennifer Fahey, thanks a lot for taking time to talk with us tonight, okay?
Thank you, Mike. My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye. Farm Aid 2011. Go to their website, farmaid.org. Check it out. Take a look. I know this is, it just doesn't, it just seems like, what? We still are dealing with these issues? Even more so now. Why am I talking about this tonight? There's all kinds of craziness going on. Why am I talking about a concert? If you just listen to our conversation with Jennifer Fahey, you know why. Every time I pick up the paper and read about the agribusiness industry, read about the commodities traders who drive up prices or try to short the market, and the farmers out there don't really have that much say about it. Like Jennifer mentioned, yeah, if you have $7 a bushel corn, the idea is somebody's going to make some money. But if you have $2 a bushel corn or $3 a bushel corn or whatever it is lately, whatever wheat is, whatever these basic commodities, food commodities, whatever they're going for, you can bet that the price was manipulated. So all of that stuff is just, and then you have the issue of farm subsidies, these huge, massive factory farms that receive subsidies that you pay for and I pay for. They have nothing to do with farming and everything to do with the further corruption of the system. Ah, Jesus, get off your soapbox, Mike. I don't know. It's just upsetting. Yeah, well, what isn't upsetting, right? Damn. Tomorrow night, Annie Nelson is going to be on the program to talk about this other thing that Willie Nelson's doing, BioWillie and the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance. So we'll cover that part of it, too. I've got to switch gears here dramatically. This is August 9th. This is the commemorative date of the nuclear bombing of Nagasaki. Hiroshima was August 6th. Nagasaki was August 9th. And the obliteration of these two Japanese cities are the only... represent the only uses of nuclear weapons in war to this date. Now, all we hear is talk about a nuclear attack on Iran, or a nuclear attack on India, or a nuclear attack on Pakistan. It's getting crazy, isn't it? For 6 months before the dropping of these two nuclear weapons, the United States intensely firebombed 67 Japanese cities. On July 26, 1945, the U.S. called for a surrender of Japan. July 26. There was no response, no immediate response. So by executive order, President Truman, the U.S. dropped the first nuclear bomb on Hiroshima on Monday, August 6th, followed by the detonation of the other one over Nagasaki on August 9th. The United States waited 11 days. Within the first 2 to 4 months of the bombings, the acute effects killed up to 166,000 people in Hiroshima and up to 80,000 in Nagasaki, with roughly half of the deaths in each city occurring on the first day. The Hiroshima Prefectural Health Department estimates that of the people who died on the day of the explosion, 60% died from flash or flame burns. 6 days after the detonation over Nagasaki, Japan announced its surrender and signed the instrument of surrender on September 2nd, officially ending the Pacific War. The role of the bombings in Japan's surrender is still being debated.
Radio right from the left. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, and this hour has been sponsored by David Burleson. Thank you, David. Thank you. I was thinking about Obama again today because of the situation, the recall elections that are occurring in Wisconsin. The polls closed out there about an hour ago. And now all the deceptions and lies and deceits that were used by the Republican operatives in the state of Wisconsin to misdirect people, to make sure the polling places where there would be a heavy turnout did not have adequate polling machines, voting machines. You know, the usual tactics that these son of a bitches use. The tactics are going to play into the results of this election. And so far, I haven't seen anything of substance regarding those six recall elections against the six Republicans in the state legislature in Wisconsin who decided it was time to join the bandwagon of murdering the middle class in that state. A lot has been said about this election. We haven't focused that much on it. But if these recall elections fail, then I think it is very clear that the American public, for the most part, has given up. Seriously. Because there is not a more clear example of a fascist takeover and a determination, once that takeover has been completed electorally, to utterly and absolutely destroy collective bargaining, to destroy the public workforce, and consequently, as a consequence of that, to further drive the middle class, in this case in Wisconsin, deeper into the dirt. And if the people of Wisconsin do not respond by throwing these sons of bitches, kicking them to the curb, and putting some people in office who care about their fellow Wisconsinite, or in a larger sense, their fellow American, then it's over. Then the game is over. Do you understand that? I mean, there will be no way for liberals or progressives or this leaderless republic that we have, and the leader's leader in the White House to explain this away. You do understand that, right? You do understand it. Okay, just checking. Remember, it was Obama that said he was, during the campaign, when he was running for president, he was going to do all he could to raise the minimum wage. How much have you heard about that in the past 2.5 years? Eh? How much have you heard about his campaign promises to strengthen collective bargaining and the union movement? How much have you heard about that since he was elected? Eh? Ah, but he's a liberal, Mike! He's a progressive! I'm still getting emails from people who have the audacity, the stupidity, the temerity, whatever, to tell me that I don't get it about Barack Obama, that I don't get it after 2.5 years, that Barack Obama is a genius who is playing all the angles. He's setting snares and traps, and eventually the Republicans are going to be hoisted by their own petard. You know what a petard is? I'm still getting those emails. You know, I don't even bother answering anymore. It's like, Jesus Christ, are you deaf, dumb, and blind? Completely cut off from your own senses. Can you not see what the man has done? Can you not see what he hasn't done? A lot of people can't. Nah, you know. Come on, Mike. You better understand. You don't know what you're talking about, Mike. Yeah. Jesse Richards' article over at TVNewsLies.org that that I mentioned last night. I didn't get into it on the air. I just said, you know, you ought to check it out. Apparently, a lot of people did. And Ray McGovern, the title of Jesse Richards' article was "Our Troops Do Not Protect Our Freedom, and We Should Stop Thanking Them for Doing So." Okay, that was put up, I think it was put up yesterday. Or the day before. I don't know. Recently. And then today, was it today? Ray McGovern at commondreams.org has a piece up about the 30 Americans and 8 Afghan troops killed Saturday when a helicopter apparently was shot down by Taliban forces. And the title of McGovern's piece, "They Died in Vain, Deal with It." And if you don't read anything else about the slaughter, the sacrifice, I should say, of American soldiers in Afghanistan and the slaughter of Afghan civilians, if you don't read anything about those issues, those two issues, please read Jesse Richards' piece at tvnewslies.org and Ray McGovern's piece at commondreams.org. These are two pieces that, you know, when I'm king of America, I will make sure that these two pieces are included in chapter one of an American history book about the history of the futility, the idiocy of warfare, of invading countries, occupying countries for no reason, and then referring to the people who do the invasion as heroes. Heroes? Dying for our country? No, they're not. Are there heroic acts in combat? Of course there are heroic acts of someone committing himself to saving the life of his comrade. But war itself, just because a person puts on a uniform and goes, does the bidding of corporate America, that is a hero? I beg to differ with you.
Finally.
Results are starting to come in now from the Wisconsin recall elections. And it's my understanding that the precincts that report first in these elections are the rural districts. Here's what we have. District 2, with 49% of the precincts reporting, the Republican incumbent is ahead by over 2,000 votes out of 18,000 cast. 57% for the Republican incumbent, 43% for the Democratic challenger. In District 8, with about 7% of the precincts reporting, the Republican incumbent has 71% of the vote. The Democratic challenger has 29% of the vote. In the, that was District 8. In District 10, the, Republican incumbent has, with 50% of the precincts reporting, the Republican incumbent has 58% of the vote, the Democratic challenger, 42%. In District 14, with 39% reporting, the Republican incumbent has 55%, the Democratic challenger has 45%. In District 18, the Republican incumbent has 54% of the vote. The Democratic challenger has 46% of the vote. And in District 32, with 24% reporting, the Republican incumbent has 49%. The Democratic challenger has 51%. You can take these numbers for what they're worth. This is from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel at their website. As we get updates here, we will let you know. And thanks to Annie for sending this information. again, you know, not to be the skunk at the picnic, but in five of the six recall elections, the Republican incumbent is ahead, in some cases massively ahead. And listening to one of the commentators during the break in Wisconsin, it's mostly rural districts that report first, which I don't know. I guess that means that the people out in the country or the suburbs or the rural areas are going to be more inclined to destroy their own economic base rather than vote Democratic or I don't know. We'll see. We'll have some more numbers for you as we can. I got an email here from Scratch. He says, "Hello, Michael. I have a copy of Jesse Richards' article, what I was mentioning right before the break, about don't call them heroes. Our troops do not protect our freedom, and we should stop thanking them for doing so." Jesse Richard at tvnewslies.org. Anyway, Scratch writes, "I have a copy of that article that I will pass around the campfire, so to speak, if need be. I'd really rather not use my own email address. I'll be listening live tonight, so if you need it, let me know and I'll send it to you." Well, thanks, Scratch, but I have it. "I'm a decorated veteran from our adventurism in Central America back in the 80s, and I know firsthand that this knowledge," in Richard's article, "needs to be distributed as widely as possible. It's been over 20 years since I left that life behind, but the memories still haunt me. I still cry myself to sleep some nights, remembering the horrible acts I was forced to commit in the interest of not only the preservation of the lives of the infantry squad I was leading, but my life as well. My son, who is now 21 years old and a senior in college, was only 3 months old then. Were the cause just and the threat to our nation's security real, I would have gladly given my life to ensure that my son would live a life free from tyranny." And then parentheses, he adds, blah, blah, blah. "It was quite the opposite. I committed atrocities in order to stay alive, so that I could return home alive and protect, as well as teach him how to protect himself from this pack of bloodthirsty wolves who are desecrating our beloved, though flawed, nation. I realized that what I experienced was like Boy Scout camp compared to my brothers and sisters serving since 9/11. But my struggle to remain sane and productive enough to be a good father, a son, a brother, uncle, and friend, I gave up on being a husband after two divorces, has been difficult, and there have been many bumps in the road. I cannot even imagine how many more lives and families will be destroyed in these endless wars. We need to shut the proverbial spigot and deal with the remaining water that will spill from the hose for who knows how many years to come. I'm sending you my real name and address. However, please refer to me as Scratch." It's just horrible. I cannot tell you how many in the past 10 years, how many letters like this from veterans, from combat veterans. I have never received an email in 27 years of doing talk radio from a service veteran, whether actual combat or not, who could state categorically and with no qualification, "Mike Malloy, I served in the military and I think I did a hell of a job defending the United States of America. I'm proud of what I did in Central America or Panama or Lebanon or wherever." You know how many wars we've been involved in, how many military actions, I should say. I've yet to receive one of those. That doesn't mean anything. I'm just saying I've yet to receive one. But I have received scores of letters where the writer, male or female, who had been in the military, some of whom had actually been in combat situations, regretted everything that he or she had been involved in and saw through the lies and the deceptions that put her there or put him there. Like I said the other night, I'm so sick of seeing these local television stations and even the cable networks focusing in on a family that is just trying to remain sane while their husband, father, mother, aunt, whatever, is off fighting wars for corporate America. Killing people and being killed, being blown away, being permanently psychologically damaged because the country we've invaded or are now occupying has something that corporate America wants. Cheap labor force, natural resources, rare earths, whatever it is. So if you can, if you have the stomach for it, go to tvnewslies.org and read Jesse Richards' story. Our troops do not protect our freedom, and we should stop thanking them for doing so. And then go to commondreams.org and read the article that Ray McGovern has up about, yes, they did die in vain. Jesus, God. When are we going to learn? I don't know. Probably that's a stupid question. All right, we have a break coming here. We'll be back momentarily and continue on around the campfire. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. The hour, some updates here. In State Senate District 2, the incumbent Robert Coles, the Republican, apparently has withstood the challenge by the Democratic Nancy Nussbaum. He has been reelected, or he's avoided the recall. In District 8, Sandra Pash, the Democratic challenger, is at 57%. Alberta Darling, the Republican incumbent, is at 43%. That's with 15 of 82 precincts reporting. In District 10, with about half of precincts reporting, the Republican has 58% of the vote, the Democratic challenger, 42%. In District 14, the Republican incumbent, Luther Olson, with about 80% of the precincts reporting, the Republican has 54% of the vote, the Democratic challenger has 46%. In District 18, with only about 15% of precincts reporting, the Republican incumbent has 53%, the Democratic challenger 47%. And in District 32, with about a third or a fourth of precincts reporting, The Republican has 49%. The Democratic challenger has 51%. So the it appears that the numbers are remaining fairly consistent as these results are posted. And again, I will just... now, Sheila Harsdorf in District 10 has been projected as the winner, the Republican incumbent. Let me see where I've got that. The Republican incumbent now is projected to be, that's, I think, two so far. Two incumbents have withstood their challenges by Democrats. You know, I'll say it again, as off the wall as it may sound, or trying to extrapolate from statewide elections, well, not statewide, elections in five or six districts in Wisconsin, trying to extrapolate to the national picture, which is risky. But I said it before and I'll restate it, that if the Republicans in Wisconsin withstand the challenge and the people of Wisconsin decide to go with the fascist, with the fascist approach, the idea that collective bargaining is dead. Jesus Christ, in Wisconsin, they're making this decision. In Wisconsin. The collective bargaining is dead. The middle class is dead. Let's all dance around the corpses. If that's the decision made by the voters of Wisconsin, then I think it's very easy to extrapolate from that and say, okay, that's it. Now, again, whether or not the votes are being counted correctly, I don't know what system they use in Wisconsin. If they use paper ballots, if they use these proprietary computer codes that can be adjusted anyway, that the owners of the codes want them adjusted. You know, who knows anymore? See, that's the thing. Who knows anymore, right? So we will watch and report as long as we can on the program tonight. These results should be in enough to make decisions as to who's been recalled and who is still the Republican office holder by the time we hit the top of the hour here. So two Republican incumbents have won their elections, and the other ones are, with one exception, the Republicans seem to be holding their own and will return to office, with the voters of Wisconsin deciding in favor of fascism. There's no equivocation here. I don't. You know, you can say whatever you want. I frankly don't care. It is, and that sounds like a bullheaded statement, and it is. It is. It's absolutely. This little punk ass that got elected governor of Wisconsin and lies through his teeth after giving away $13 or $14 million of state money to his cronies, and then declaring that there's a $13 or $14 million budget shortfall, and in order to balance it, they have to destroy public unions. If that's what the people in Wisconsin want, fine. I mean, we've been blocked out of Wisconsin. We were on the mic 90.1, doing just great, had a good audience, and Clear Channel decided to kick our ass to midnight to 3 a.m. This is how it works now, folks. You know who they put in my place? Was it Alan Combs? Because he bought Fox. He works for Fox, Fox Radio. He bought his way. Fox Radio bought the time on Clear Channel. So what happens to this program? Gone. We'll be right back.
go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
Scared about the future, you wonder what you're gonna do.
It is 25 before the hour. In Nebraska, a Senate candidate there, a Republican, John Bruning, he is the Nebraska Attorney General. And he's the Tea Party or the Teabag candidate running to unseat Senator Ben Nelson, Democrat in Nebraska. I don't know why Nelson usually votes with the Republicans, doesn't he? Isn't he the one that usually votes Republican? Anyway, this guy, the Nebraska Attorney General, John Bruning, is comparing welfare recipients to raccoons. Oh, my God. He also takes a shot at the EPA. It's a video shot by the group American Bridge 21st Century. That is Media Matters. Who is it that put together Media Matters? David Brock. anyway, they're the ones that took the video. In this video, Bruning tells the story of a local construction project that was halted so as not to harm an endangered species of beetle. So Bruning stands there and he says to his audience, so the biologist has to go out there and he sets these traps. They put a rat carcass in the bottom and the beetles crawl up and they fall into the bottom of it. And they put all these buckets up and down the side of the road and they capture all these burying beetles, are called. The biologist goes out in the morning, grabs the beetles, and they take them 2 miles down and they gently let the beetles out so that the beetles will survive. Bruning says there's a problem with this plan that the biologist or EPA or whoever it is concocted. He says the raccoons figure out the beetles are in the bucket. And it's like grapes in a jar. The raccoons, they're not stupid. They're going to do the easy way. If we make it easy for them, just like welfare recipients all across America, if we don't make them go to work, they're going to take the easy way out. In Nebraska. Now, in these recall elections, the Democrats have got to get 3 seats in order to regain control of the Wisconsin House or Wisconsin Senate. But keep in mind, there is another election coming up another recall election coming up, what, in a week or two, with 3 Democrats who are being challenged. Madness. Tina Brown, who was the editor of what, Vanity Fair for so long, and is now the editor of Newsweek, is really catching hell. The cover of her magazine, we mentioned this the other night, has that picture of the Queen of Rage, and it has Michelle Bachmann on the cover. And Bachmann's ignoring it, but her supporters are going just ape crazy, you know, ape poop. Almost at it. They're going nuts over this picture. And even organizations like the National Organization for Women or civil rights organizations, not civil rights, but political organizations that normally are to the left of center, they're all coming out and in defense of Bachmann's supporters' position that this picture was designed to diminish Michelle Bachmann. And what I said the other night, I don't get this. This woman is a liar. She is probably, I'm not a doctor, and I certainly have never had a conversation but from listening to what she says, she's nuts. She has no grasp of American history, nothing. And somebody on television today made the point that anyone who is running for president of the United States should not be treated with disrespect. Are you kidding me? Look what they did to John Kerry. You know, it always works this way, doesn't it? Huh? The Democrat Democrats can be slandered, lied about, treated like dirt, the Democratic candidates for whatever office. The lies just pour forth like a fountain from just about every media outlet in America. But let a crazy wacko like Michelle Bachmann display her crazy wackoness in a photograph. The goddamn photograph is her. I mean, it's not photoshopped. It's her. Who hasn't taken an unflattering photo? I mean, do you like all your photos? No, you don't. There's some of me out there that are used by some of these right-wing. And what's wrong with your right-wing blog spots? You sons of bitches are falling down on the job. You haven't written anything about me, calling me a traitor and a commie and a dirty dog. And, you know, you want to murder my family. Come on. It's time for you guys to give me a little more publicity. You're falling down on the job. But when these right-wing sump holes, these little dung pits of blog spots on the right, when they put a picture of me up, you know, it scares the hell out of me. No, I'm not running for president. No, I'm not going to ever be on the cover of Newsweek. But these little crying, whining, crybaby bastards, and what really gets me are the liberals who are out there on television, here they go again, supporting the idea that poor Michelle Bachmann is being blasted because she's a female, while the editor of Newsweek happens to be a female. The selection process of what's on the cover is made by a female. Maybe Tina Brown was just trying to alert America that there's another goddamn psychopath running for president. Nobody did that to Bush, right? Did you see Bush, a photograph of Bush on the cover of anything? All those years when he was destroying the country that might have embarrassed him? But here we go again. Here are all these left of center or liberals or whatever agreeing with the Bachmann operatives that this picture was abomination. Oh, they're never fair to Republicans. They're never fair to conservatives. You sons of bitches, I am so sick of you turning the facts ass over elbows and coming up with what you want the American public to believe is true. What do you mean they never do this to Democrats or liberals? I think Newsweek ought to run it again next week and the week after and the week after that and the week after that. Keep her picture out there. She's out of her goddamn mind. She's a threat to anything that even resembles representative government. She's a liar. She's stupid, ignorant, has no sense of history, nothing. She's a religious cult fanatic. She says Jesus talks to her in her bedroom. The queers are out to get her. There are people lurking in the bushes. And all these liberals are out defending the position. Oh, yeah, well, Newsweek shouldn't have taken that, shouldn't have put that picture on there. Oh, give me a break. Michelle Bachmann, when this country starts treating these kinds of psychopaths as serious candidates for the presidency of the United States. Well, wait a minute. What am I saying? George Bush was treated as a serious candidate, and they gave him the election twice. Wisconsin State Senate District 14 with 86% of the vote in, the Republicans way ahead. Well, I don't know. Regarding what's going on in Wisconsin, what's going on in this country, Frederick Douglass said this in 1857. Power concedes nothing without demand. It never did and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you found the exact measure of injustice and wrong that will be imposed upon them. And these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or with both. The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppose. So, again, you know, as I always say, what's it going to take? At what point do we, the people, we don't have to do what's going on in London, But isn't it time we at least did what's going, what happened in Tahrir Square? Isn't it time that we, just let the oppressive factions in this country understand that we're not going to take it anymore? We can't even do a Tiananmen Square thing. How long ago was that? Was that 22 years ago? Was that 1989? Oh my God. We'll be back.
The president raises his eyes like he forgot his lines. He's waiting for some inspiration to awaken his muddled mind. He thinks he hears a still small voice whispering in his ear. Something he learned in Bible camp, or maybe from his daddy dear. Do unto others before they do unto you. Praise the Lord and hit 'em hard, the devil must have his due. As all the weapons of Uncle Sam, the smallpox Indian blankets, the bombs that beat Japan. Bless the cops and prisons that make us free. This land was made.
Ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
In Wisconsin, in State Senate District 8, the Democratic challenger, Sandy Pasch, has 56% of the vote. The Republican incumbent has 44%. Well, that's certainly good news. We'll see what happens. Regarding all the death in Asia, you know, you have to go back to Rudyard Kipling. Whose poems were about pretty much in support of British imperialism in the 19th century, but I think he came to understand. You can tell by his poetry that he came to understand the futility of trying to maintain the British Empire. And one of my favorites, a quickie, is and Ray McGovern used this today in his piece. It is not wise for the Christian white to hustle the Asian brown. For the Christian riles and the Asian smiles and weareth the Christian down. At the end of the fight lies a tombstone white with the name of the late deceased. And the epitaph drear. A fool lies here who tried to hustle the East. And, of course, the East in Kipling's day was the Hindu Kush, Pakistan, Afghanistan, all the stands, Tajikistan, this is Stan, that is Stan. You may know that Verizon, workers at Verizon are involved in a strike. Steve Early, a former organizer, national union representative for the Communication Workers of America, said today, quote, "This Verizon work stoppage is the sixth strike in the last 28 years by some of the telephone workers involved. They've been in the forefront of resisting healthcare cost shifting and other concession demands since private sector employers first went on the offensive after the air traffic controllers strike was defeated in 1981. If a company that made nearly $20 billion over the last 4 years can claim that it needs givebacks, then every other unionized firm in America will be clamoring for them even more aggressively than they are now. So there's a lot at stake here. And not just for 45,000 members of the Communications Workers of America Union. and the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, who walked out on Saturday night. And if you want to read Steve Early's recent op-ed that appeared in the Boston Globe, just do a Google on the title, On the Picket Lines. On the Picket Lines. Ay, 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 ay. Coming up next hour, I want to tell you what's happening to physicians in Florida as a result of a law signed by the fascist governor there, Rick Scott. And also, just a brief little description of what George Bush wrought in his 8 years of the stolen presidency that was handed to him by five members of the U.S. Supreme Court. Oh, and by the way, we don't live all that far from some of these Tennessee nuclear plants. From a website about clean technology, which does not include nuclear power, says as temperatures across the South have skyrocketed in record-breaking heat waves, the water in the Tennessee River, where three Tennessee Valley Authority nuclear power plants discharge their cooling water, the temperature of the Tennessee River is 90 degrees. Because hot rivers are not good for fish, by law, nuclear plants must not heat rivers above 86.9 degrees with their discharged water. But that now quaint-seeming environmental protection that was passed decades ago, well before global warming began to impact air and water temperatures, is meaningless. Summers like these make environmental niceties like not overheating rivers with nuclear cooling water a bit irrelevant, because the river in question is already as hot as a hot tub. Now, because of that, these three nuclear power plants have had to shut down for a second time this summer. The shutdown marks the second summer in a row the TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, has had to shut down nuclear power plants as local rivers have reached record temperatures. Last year's shutdown cost the company $50 million in replacement power, which was immediately passed along to customers, of course. Rivers so hot that the water used to cool the spent nuclear rods can't be discharged into the rivers. Not because of an EPA. You know, that's the thing. Wait till these psychopathic Republican governors who are trying to gut and destroy everything the EPA has ever come up with, as minimal as the stuff the EPA has come up with, wait till they discover that the EPA rules no longer apply because a larger force, global warming, has taken over. What are these rat bastards going to do then? Demand that the sun dial back its radiation? Pray that God shut down the sun? You. Oh, my God. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. And yes, this hour is also underwritten, sponsored by Farm Aid 2011. As we have been talking about the entire week, biodiesel, the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance, which is bringing you BioWilly, a biodiesel company that mitigates the impact of greenhouse gases. And of course, Farm Aid 2011, this year, August 13th, this Saturday in Kansas City. Go to farmaid.org for all kinds of information, and also to take part in the concert on Saturday. Well, not that I don't mean you can pick up a guitar and play, but you can, well, you, I guess you could in your living room or your whatever. I'm still just very frustrated, flabbergasted at what's going on. I guess that's not going to go away. It's not going to go away for you either. I was reading the Times this morning about what will happen in this country if our, and I say this tongue-in-cheek, our recession takes the double dip. I always thought double dip was, you know, had to do with ice cream. It did, you know, for the longest time, and now it means chaos and disorder and destruction. The riots in the UK, I think, are a harbinger, a possible harbinger of what could happen here. I hope people are paying attention. Joe Nocera, who used to write on the business section of the New York Times, is now on the op-ed pages of the New York Times. He moved. He had a column, was it today or yesterday? And as he asked in the column, has any president in American history left behind as much lasting damage as George W. Bush? Think about that for a minute. Anybody, any time in the history of this country left a mess, a political and economic mess greater than George W. Bush? The answer, of course, is hell no. The damage that this freak did, and now there's another freak who is starting to rise up out of the muck of Texas. Perry, another Texas governor, with his psychotic prayer event over the last weekend. But think about George W. Bush. In addition to two unfinished wars, wars of opportunity, wars in violation of every goddamn law that we have signed regarding international law or agreement regarding invading other countries, Bush left those. They're still killing people. Like what happened over the weekend, 30 Americans blown into bone fragments. Bush also set us on the path for our current financial chaos, the mess that we're dealing with. As Nocera points out, the Bush tax cuts, which turned a surplus into a growing deficit, have been disastrous. Who has won with the Bush tax cuts? Who's come out ahead? Come on, be real. Even you right-wing brain-dead half-asses out there, who, you know, the ones that, you, the ones that sit in front of Fox or listen to Beck or the rest of these monsters and go, yeah, tax cuts. How has it worked out for you there, booby? Huh? How are those Bush tax cuts worked for you? You feel good about them? Huh? Do you really? You crazy, crazy morons. James Fallows had an article in The Atlantic magazine back in 2005. The article predicted a meltdown as a result of these tax cuts. In the article, he said that the reducing tax revenue, quote, to its lowest level as a share of the economy in the modern era was going to result in disaster. Hello, disaster. How are you today? Huh? Now, Standard & Poor's, in its report the other day when they downgraded and did their little part in trying to destroy capitalism, bless your hearts, S&P suggested that they did not believe that Congress would let the cuts expire at the end of 2012 as they're supposed to. And you and I both know that that won't happen. It didn't happen with Obama and these filthy-ass Republicans when they were supposed to expire a year ago. And the can was kicked down the road. You really think that in an election year, they're going to let these tax cuts expire? You can hear it already, can't you? Tax increases! Tax increases! Tax increases! But Republican, we'll keep the tax cuts. We'll put more money in your pocket. You know it's coming. You know it's coming. So, partly based on that, aside from their political agenda, Standard & Poor's said, look, these tax cuts aren't going to expire in 2012. And as a result, trillions more revenue are going to be lost. In 2003, Bush pushed through prescription drug coverage for Medicare recipients. Unfunded. They were paid for with debt. The Chinese paid for it. Prescription drug coverage that was designed specifically to bankrupt Medicare. It wasn't designed to help people over the age of, 65 or whatever. George Bush? Republicans? Thinking about people's needs? Give me a break. Those prescription drug benefits were designed, like everything Bush Cheney did, to destroy America utterly and absolutely. Well, what did Cheney say? Deficits don't matter. And in a sense, he's right. But they matter when everybody pretends like they matter. If we all pretend like there's a monster in the basement, and we all really believe there's a monster in the basement, somebody in the family, probably grandpa, is going to have a heart attack. Oh, there's a monster in the basement. Even though there isn't one. The Comptroller General at the time, in 2003, one David M. Walker, described 2003 as, quote, the most reckless fiscal year in the history of this republic. And some $13 trillion was added in future entitlement costs. $13 trillion. What is the national debt right now? Well, what is this number that everybody's freaking out about? What is it? $13 trillion? $14 trillion? And according to the Comptroller General, the math guy, the numbers guy, I don't know David Walker from Adam's House Cat. I don't know if he's a freak, a reasonable person. I have no idea. But he said 2003 was the worst, the most reckless fiscal year in the history of the United States. Because in that year, some $13 trillion in future costs was added to the debt. And these pig bastards out here have the audacity to blame this on Obama. Obama has provided a failure of leadership. He didn't get us into this. It's just he won't do a damn thing to get us out. And we could be gotten out very simply. I swear to God. You know, after I offered my Malloy save the American economy plan last night, got a quick email from Prairie Two. He said, well, those programs you're suggesting that in 435 congressional districts, great idea. However, that takes a little time. So go ahead and get that started. Here's for immediacy. Just have Obama come out and say, okay, let's get some construction company bids in here, because look around just at road repair, just filling potholes, for God's sake. How many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs that would generate? And Obama won't do it. And he won't do it because he is not a leader. He has no idea on how to lead this country. Left, right, liberal, conservative, it doesn't matter anymore. He's a lousy leader. He does nothing. He comes out and gives these half-assed speeches like he did the other day. No matter what some agency may say, we've always been and always will be a triple-A country. Ooh, how's that? Remember he said they will always be a triple-A country. Oh, good. Thanks, Mr. President.
Management. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. I wonder how many different kinds of aid are going to be necessary when we hit this double dip. We have Farm Aid coming up this Saturday. And this is one of the major failures slash lies of the Barack administration, of Obama administration. Remember all the talk about aid for families whose, all of a sudden, through no fault of their own, their mortgages had them underwater where it concerned paying off the mortgage because of this phony bubble created by the predator capitalists on Wall Street? Remember? And Obama, there were billions of dollars going to go for the relief of these people. What have you heard about that recently? So what are we going to have at some point? Are we going to have someone with a social conscience like a Willie Nelson provide relief for homeowners? What's that going to be called? Foreclosure aid? There's going to be a concert like that? And what about food? What about families that cannot provide enough nutritional income, balance, energy for their families? Food aid. That has a nice ring to it, doesn't it? This problem could be solved. It really could. You know, the 20 million Americans who are desperately in need of work, good paying jobs, using Prairie 2's timeline, okay, it could be to work within months. A lot of people could be put to work within weeks. If the Obama administration, if Barack Obama would just show some leadership. We have had no leadership in this country since the 2000 stolen, I don't even call it an election, appointment of the president. Nothing. It's been 11 years now. What have we had? Recession? War? And as far as this, do you notice one thing about this crop, this current crop of Republican candidates? They are all trying to out-God each other. Have you noticed that? This connection between various putrefactions of Christianity that these people, and I'm including the Mormons here, I know they don't consider themselves to be, they consider everyone else to be Gentiles. They are the elite, and we have two of them running now. But the Christianization of politics, the political system in this country, every single one of these people, with their prayer meetings and their spirit exorcisms and their exhortations of the supreme being and their constant pounding the Bible and beating people to death with this religious craziness. Have you noticed that? So one can draw a conclusion, can't one, that a great deal of this problem is being caused by Christians, by this crazy brand of Christianity? There was a piece in the Washington Post blog site, I think. What is that? It's the Bookworm blog site in the Washington Post. Who writes that? Who writes it? Steve? Is it Steve? Somebody? I don't have his name. Yeah, Stephen. Stephen Levingston. And he asked a question, are some political parties more dangerous than others? He talks about this guy named James Gilligan. He's a psychiatrist and professor at New York University. He has a new book, Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. He presents it as a kind of murder mystery, or more precisely, a look at a mystery about murder. which includes self-murder or suicide. And what he did, this author, James Gilligan, he tracked rates of suicide and homicide over a century from 1900 to 2007 and was intrigued by the peaks and valleys that he saw in the murder rate, self-murder and murder of other people. He writes, over that period, I saw three large, sudden, and prolonged increases and decreases in these measures of lethal violence, which reached a peak and were then followed by equally dramatic decreases. And he was puzzled over this until he realized that all three of the epidemics of lethal violence in the United States correspond with the presidential election cycle. Now, you know where I'm going with this, don't you? I know you do. Stick around. I'll give you the rest of this story when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy.
You know the life I've been living, people. Oh, Lord, for a good many years. Sound like to me I can hear this morning, people. Death bell ringing all in my ear. Sound like to me I can hear this morning, people.
Progressive Talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. So this writer, James Gilligan, who is a psychiatrist professor at NYU, has a book, Why Some Politicians Are More Dangerous Than Others. And what Gilligan did was track suicide and homicide rates over a century from 1900 to 2007. And he noticed peaks and valleys. And he saw that the peaks and valleys corresponded to the presidential election cycle. What Gilligan found was that suicides and homicides started climbing to epidemic levels following the election of a Republican president. Now, he also discovered that the rates remained around epidemic levels throughout the time Republicans occupied the White House. Gilligan writes, quote, the increase began during their first year or years in office and peaked in their last year or several years. Suicide rate, murder rate. The Republican Party is a death party. How many times has your humble and obedient servant suggested that on this program? Well, here's your proof. Now, what happened when a Democratic president moved in after this murder spree, this death spree, what happened? The epidemic levels of violence in this country, according to Gilligan, the NYU professor and psychiatrist, began to reverse direction in the first year or two of a Democratic administration, and the rates reached their lowest point in the last year or two of the Democratic term. Just coincidence, right? It has nothing to do with reality, right? Well, Gilligan disagrees. His analysis, he says, proves otherwise. The changes in the rates of violence occur, quote, with a magnitude and consistency that could not be attributed to chance alone, end quote. So what's behind it? What is the murder? What's the driving force of this spike over a century in this country of murder and suicide? Well, according to the author of this book, the policies of Republican administrations increase socioeconomic distress. which, as you know from other studies that have been published, it has all sorts of results that lead to higher rates of murder and suicide, while Democratic administrations reduce socioeconomic distress, which brings down the levels of violence. Do you remember, you want a quick example? As much as I didn't like the guy because of some of his policies, think Clinton. Can you remember what happened during the Clinton years? I know 95% of you can't because your brains are mush because of television and talk radio and the rest of this garbage. But if you think for a moment, the murder rate, the rate of violence, violent crime, murder rates and suicide rates plunged. I can remember talking about it on the air saying, well, it's because, you know, being the smart ass that I am, it's because everybody has a job. Nobody has any inclination or time. There's no time to commit suicide. There's no time to work a murder into your daily schedule. Because everybody's working. Remember that? Remember that? Well, Republicans and these murderous Christians that and the capitalists, when you put these three together, oh my God. Casino or predatory capitalism. Now you have these Christian freaks, these preachers to say blackbirds are dying because of gay soldiers and the Statue of Liberty is a demonic idol and Hurricane Katrina was punishment because homosexuality in New Orleans and what else? Jesus actually opposed the minimum wage and believed in the capital gains tax. And I mean, just on and on. These are the people who support Rick Perry. These are the people that Rick Perry surrounds himself with, and don't kid yourself. Bachman has a gang of these psychopaths of her own, as do the two Mormon contenders, as does the Godfather Pizza Man. This connection between violence and this evangelical Christianity and predatory capitalism and Republicans don't, I mean, surely you see the nexus. Surely you see the interconnectedness of all this. Tell me you do. Just tell me you do. And now comes a book. Why some Republicans are more, why some politicians are more dangerous than others. By one James Gilligan, Dr. James Gilligan, psychiatrist, professor, NYU, who will show you in the book the corresponding peaks and valleys between Republican administrations and violence, Democratic administrations and the lack of violence. But oh no, that's just nonsense. That's just one of those pointy-headed New York professors. Has no basis in reality, right? You want a quick example of right-wing madness? You know when you go to a doctor, and the doctor, if he's a good doctor, she's a good doctor, will ask questions that some people might consider rude. Dr. Aaron Marcus, in today's New York Times, has a piece about what happens now to doctors in Florida if they ask their patients whether or not there's a gun in the house? But when you go to a doctor, if you've got a good doctor, they ask questions like, do you wear your seatbelt? How much alcohol do you drink? Do you use recreational drugs? Do you smoke? Have you ever injected yourself with anything? Do you have sexual relations? If so, with men, with women, with both? These are just questions that a good physician will ask you to try to get a profile of who you are, what you're presenting to him or her. They've been a standard part of medical interviews for I don't know, since going back to Hippocrates. You know, ask questions. That's what a good doctor does, because the answers tend to reveal clues about a person's symptoms or physical findings on an exam. As Marcus says, if a person says he or she drinks heavily or has used intravenous drugs, a doctor will probably be more alert to signs of liver problems when doing the physical exam and more inclined to order certain blood tests. But there's one customary question that this doctor, Aaron Marcus, and other doctors in Florida are no longer allowed to ask. In June, Governor Rick Scott signed a law barring Florida doctors from routinely asking patients if they own a gun. You can't do it anymore. The law authorizes patients to report doctors for, quote, unnecessarily harassing, end quote, them about gun ownership. And the law makes it illegal to routinely document firearm ownership information in a patient's medical records. Can you believe this? Now, the penalties for violating the law include disciplinary action by the Florida Board of Medicine, which could include citations, fines, and, you ready? Right out of the Joe Stalin playbook, remedial education. Doctors have to go to a re-education course or camp if they ask a question in Florida of a patient, do you have a gun in the house? Remedial education? This bill was introduced in the state legislature after a pediatrician dismissed a mother from his practice when she refused angrily to answer a routine question about whether she kept a gun in her house. The doctor said at the time that he asked so he could offer appropriate safety advice, just as he customarily asks patients if they have a swimming pool. And he asked teenagers if they use their cell phones when they drive. He said he dismissed the mother as his patient because he felt they could not establish a trusting doctor-patient relationship. Now, advocates of gun rights, you know, the crazy sons of bitches in the NRA, these brain dead moronic, like Wayne the Peter, what is he now? Wayne the Peter is the CEO of the NRA. What is he? I don't care. But advocates of gun rights argue that routine questions about firearms violate their privacy. What? But asking a woman whether or not her miscarriage was self-induced, that's not. And the questions about whether or not they own a firearm offend common decency. That's what the NRA says. You can't ask a question like that because you're violating my right to privacy with my doctor, you hypocritical son of a bitches, every single one of you. But a woman who goes in and wants to have an abortion, you will have your ass in there. You want to lock her up, lock the doctor up. You sick, miserable psychopaths, you. Let me calm down during this commercial break, because there's more here. Before the hour. So in Florida now, if you're a physician, you may not ask your patient whether or not there's a gun in the house, because that would be a violation of patient doctor privacy, according to the NRA. However, if your patient is a woman who comes to you seeking an abortion, then the NRA types, these crazy Christian right-wing psychopaths who are just ripping this country into pieces, they have a right at that point to inject themselves. And you, the doctor, you, the patient, you are subject to all sorts of harassment and possible jail. Marion Hammer is a former president of the National Rifle Association who lobbied for passage of this bill. said in letters to NRA members that gun-owning parents had complained to her for many years about pediatricians' inquiries, which she believes are ineffective at preventing gun inquiry, ineffective at preventing gun injuries. This woman, former head of president of the NRA, said that such inquiries are part of a political anti-gun agenda by the American Academy of Pediatrics.
Ooh! Ooh! These doctors want to take your guns! Be on guard! Be on guard, you Nazi asses! Be on guard! Pediatricians are going to come to your house and take your gun! Woohoo! She said, this crazy woman, Marion Hammer, this blathering right-wing psychopath said, you don't go to a doctor to be interrogated or intimidated! There's a clear line between violating privacy rights and imparting safety information. Oh, really? Violating privacy rights? You hypocrite. You gun psychopath. If a doctor wants to inquire about the possibility of a suicide or a homicide inside a family because of the presence of a gun, you get your bloomers in a wad, lady. But you have a right to stick it in there where it doesn't belong about whether or not a woman is seeking an abortion. How dare you even breathe the same air that I breathe? You don't belong here. You're from a different planet. Go!
The American Academy of Pediatrics takes the position that guns are a public health issue and that pediatricians have a duty to ask about ownership because, well, you know, firearm injuries affect a large number of their patients. Firearms account for a third of all deaths from injury among teenagers. And 20% of all deaths among people ages 1 through 19. Now, obviously, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that parents not have a gun in the home. And when guns are present, it suggests that they be kept unloaded in a secure locked place with the bullets separately stored. Well, gosh, that just sounds like a gun-grabbing agenda to me, doesn't it to you, truth seekers? I mean, every time I take Molly to her pediatrician, her doctor says, well, Mr. Malloy, I'd like to ask you about guns in your house, but I'm not allowed to. Oh, wait a minute. I live in Georgia, not Florida. Jesus, God.
The president of the American Pediatric Association says, look, there's no political agenda. We're talking about the safety of children. And the best way to protect children is to teach the parents how to protect the children. And now some pediatricians are worrying that if they don't ask about firearms, that could put them at risk for a malpractice claim. Especially psychiatrists, if the patient subsequently dies of or is injured by a gunshot. Psychiatrists routinely inquire about guns. And a psychiatrist is an MD. And the psychiatrists that live in Florida who ask a clearly disturbed patient that comes in for therapy, do you have a gun in the house, now faces a re-education camp. All right, not a re-education camp. Remedial education. A doctor who asks the question, do you have a gun in the house, in Florida. I wish I had a saw about the size. Who was it that said, give me a lever long enough and I can move the earth? Who was that? It was one of the Greek mathematicians. Archimedes? I don't know. Give me a lever long enough and I can move the earth. Well, yeah. I wish I had a saw big enough where I could start Just right at the armpit of Florida, Archimedes said that, right at the armpit of Florida, just below Tallahassee, and start sawing. And saw all the way across that hellhole state all the way over to roughly Ponte Vedra. Just cut it off and let it float away. That is after my children and grandchildren were evacuated, of course, because I've got kids that live there and grandkids. But who's your favorite author? All these books you read about Florida?
Carl
Hyacin. If you want to know about the craziness in Florida, former, I guess he still writes for the Miami Herald. I don't know. Incredibly funny writer who's written, I don't know what, 10 books, 12 books. You've read them all, haven't you? About the crazy people in Florida. And now this. If you're a pediatrician, if you're an MD, which includes all the specialties from psychiatry to pediatrics, it doesn't make any difference. And you inquire about a gun, you may need remedial education as a physician if you practice in Florida. Okay. I'm going to go take a nice hot shower now. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.